Holmes & Hops is proudly supported by Platt Insurance, your local independent insurance agency offering auto, home, life, business, and farm insurance. They also have a team of specialists that help you with insuring your brewery or winery. Platt Insurance, helping you protect your tomorrow. For more information or a quote, please call them at 330-856-6244 or visit them on the web at plattinsurance.com. Hello, everyone. Lisa Resnick. I am here with Bill Lawson of the Mahoning Valley Historical Society. I just want to let you know he did mouth that to me, so I didn't mess it up, so I appreciate that. It's because I got your name right. I always mess up people's last names. Phonics was never my strong suit.
Well, my last name is pretty easy.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Really?
Yes. Okay. Steve VC, not Vessie. I called him Vessie.
All right.
Or besides the fact of, like, when I moved from here to D.C. and then Northern Virginia, there were different names like McLean or Vienna, which here it's Vienna, right? Or is it the other way around?
Other way around.
But yes, they're all spelled the same. So quite honestly, I mean,
North Lima.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Campbell. It's really Camel.
Camel.
Exactly. All right. So I have Bill on here today because I do think that the history of our community is extremely important in where we are now and what we're looking forward to in the future. And the other thing about Bill, and which he emailed me, but so before we get into all that good stuff, is Bill mentioned that, like myself, he was the, what was your beer choice in school?
Oh, PBR.
Oh, now see
Miller
that
High Life.
PBR is very, it's very hipster now.
I know. And I think, really?
Yes.
Okay. But so the cheap domestics was our staple, really.
Yeah, mine was the Beast and Natty Light, as I mentioned before. So with that, Bill claims that he is not an IPA hoppy type of guy.
Correct.
And which I understand. I used to be there. So I thought we'd do a little taste test. For all the brewer's sake, we're not going to mention the beer's names. We'll wait till whichever ones he likes, then we'll say those ones.
Okay.
So try the first. Actually, first try the one all the way to your right.
Okay.
How's that one?
It's nice. Just a little bit of an aftertaste, but it's smooth. So, yeah, that's good.
So that is Noble Creatures Youngstonian. So all the breweries will have like their introductory beer for all of us who are a little bit more apprehensive to the hop flavor or IPAs or even stouts.
Okay.
So that is their introductory one. So if you wanted to go to Noble Creature, enjoy some smoked meat from Zizzo's Barbecue, now you know you have a go-to beer to have.
Good. Well, I've actually been at Noble Creatures pre-pandemic, and it's a nice atmosphere, and I've actually had some good brews there.
They do have really good beers. Do you like sours?
I don't know. Where does that fall? Like I said, I am not a connoisseur.
Sours are not hoppy at all, but they have that tartness that you would have when you have like a fruit without sugar on it. That would be my best explanation to it. Like a cranberry maybe before it's been doused with sugar.
Okay. Like a shandy or?
Yes.
Something, like that? Okay.
Something similar to that. And the rule of thumb is 3 sips for your palate to acclimate to the sour flavor.
Okay.
So just don't turn away after the first sip. Give it 2 other sips and see. Try. All right. Try the middle one. Was that a good one?
It is. I just got a little bubble in my throat there. Yeah, that has more of the sour thing going.
So this one is your Penguin City Light.
I like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So another really great go-to beer, especially game day. So the other two, by the way, they follow my rule of thumb of under 5% ABV. It's usually my, it's a safe route to take for me. And
then, on a work day. Yeah.
Yes. And then give the other one a shot.
Mm. Smells good.
Yes, it does.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You like that one?
Yeah, that's really, it has that smell and that taste, but then it doesn't have an aftertaste, really.
So that would be your more hoppy one. That is Birdfish's Milkshake IPA.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm. I'll have to try that. My daughter actually lives in Columbiana, like half a block from Birdfish, and I just haven't been there yet.
Well, hopefully soon we'll be walking around, popping into different establishments often and frequently, and it'll be grand. So now let's get down to the nitty-gritty.
Okay.
Are you ready? So I did give Bill a list of questions I definitely wanted to tap into, but I also gave him the ability to speak freely as well.
Okay.
All right, ready?
So, fire away.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, working at the Mahoney Valley Historical Society, you have an interest in history. I at least hope so.
Yes.
But the question really is so, childhood, where'd you grow up? And then how did this love and passion for this, for the history of our area, or does it even extend beyond that, really come into play?
Okay. I'm a local native, born here in Youngstown, Northside Hospital.
Oh, there you go.
Grew up in Boardman Township and went to schools 13 years there. I left for a year and a half to attend University of Cincinnati.
Okay.
I majored in industrial design.
Oh, wow.
And then after, well, about halfway through the fall quarter, I said, I don't want to do this, really. And so transferred to YSU and finished my bachelor's degree there. And then later got a master's degree in history from YSU. So I think, to answer your question, there's a couple of factors in my life that led me to this profession. One is my dad, I'd say you would call a history buff. He loved military history. He loved to chase old canals or even existing canals. He was into that whole engineering feat, transportation. Like his father, my grandfather, worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad. And he grew up in Pittsburgh. So he had books. Popular in the 50s and 60s was the American Heritage series. Bruce Catton was a historian who was the editor and did a lot of the writing for it. And there were very popular histories that people bought sets of the World War I and II set, the Civil War set, a lot of other publications. And my father had a lot of those, and they were on the bookshelf. And as a kid, I would just pull them down and look at them because the photographs were interesting, and I read the stories that went along with it. So,
what did they focus on?
Well, American Heritage focused on some of the more important things like the American Revolution, the American Civil War, our participation in World War I and World War II, and then they had a magazine also that they publish that got into broader topics and histories. So that was an introduction as a child. Also, when we had family vacations, invariably we ended up at a historic site, you know, a fort, a canal, or something like that.
My husband's father also would take them, and which my husband too has a love of history.
Mm-hmm.
And his father used to take them to different sites along like battlegrounds in like Virginia and other areas throughout New York, all those different areas they would go visit as a child.
Well, that's great. And that his father gave him that opportunity. We didn't go to battlefields per se. A lot of our vacations were in the Great Lakes, Erie, Ontario. So Fort Necessity, Fort George up in Ontario, which is right at the mouth of the Niagara River, across from Fort Niagara. And so that was always interesting, and obviously I still remember that today. And so that was important in my formation, but also the time period when I came of age. And in terms of our regions and our local history, probably in our memory and in the last century or so, it was the most important period in the region's history, and that was when our steel industry literally collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to point out that it started in September of 1977, literally 2 weeks after I started high school, when Youngstown Sheet and Tube announced they were closing the Camel Works and laying off 5,000 people. And all through my high school days until I graduated in 1981, and then I think it was 2 or 3 weeks after my high school graduation, the last blast furnace in Youngstown and Mahoning County actually was blown out, and it was done. So that was my formative coming-of-age years. And then coming back in, well, it would have been 1983 when I started back at YSU, it was just the after effect of that was going on all around the community. And it was a very interesting time to be on YSU's campus, because along with traditional students, you had a lot of steel workers who were thrown out of work, who were back in school getting an education and retraining. And they added a lot to the classes that I was in, where you had men and women in their 30s and 40s who had a different perspective than a 20-year-old did. And so it was a really dynamic time on campus. And also throughout the 1980s, just sorting out where are we going as a community, since this industry that for 80 to 90 years had dominated the local economy and really politics and everything else, the way that we were formed as a community. So these were all questions that were being asked as I was finishing my undergraduate degree and really after I started graduate school. So I think that also drew me in to look at our region's history and the city of Youngstown's history and to be very interesting in it. And
do you think that you originally went to Cincinnati looking at industrial engineering because of what was happening during your high school years as well?
No. My father he worked in the refractories business, and they sold fire bricks to the local steel mills, and that was his connection. My mother's father worked for Republic Steel for 40-plus years and retired.
Which will now be Penguin City. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, the Pollock plant there. And and my father had actually passed away before Black Monday.
Oh, wow.
And so our family is going through a transition. And so he would have been seriously affected in his job.
Yes.
Had he been around for that. But I guess the point is...
So that's what drew you over to the industrial side?
Oh, okay. Right. No, I was really interested. I was artistically inclined in high school. And I wanted to design cars.
Oh.
And my grades were not good enough to go to an elite school like General Motors Institute. And University of Cincinnati had a program in industrial design, which related to that. And it's a very good program. And
The university is a great university,
it
too.
It is, for sure. And it was very intensive. My freshman year, all the foundation classes, really invigorating. And literally the start of the sophomore year, then we got into the industrial design studio phase. And I think I knew in a couple of weeks, no, this isn't going to work for me. And so coming home was really a matter of economics, and much cheaper to live at home and commute to school than to live on campus or off campus
100%.
In Cincinnati. Right. And from then it was a matter of, well, what do I want to do? And I gravitated taking some of the history courses there and said, this is really interesting. And And also in undergraduate level, it's the first time I really appreciated or locked into how it was taught on that level of academia. And it was very fascinating. The lectures, the research that we did, and to begin to start thinking critically. And that all moved me right into being a history major.
Did you ever think about going back and teaching? You're like, no.
I enjoy teaching in terms of lecturing and giving presentations. I finished a master's degree after having been married and having two kids and a house and a mortgage. And it took a long time. And ever since I finished the master's degree, I've never had a desire to go any further as far as a PhD or to teach on the university level. I have guest lectured at YSU, and I think that's very interesting, but I just haven't pursued it. And maybe it's something I can do later as far as an adjunct or something, but it just hasn't been in my mind up until now.
Well, so how'd you end up at the Mahoning Valley Historical Society?
I was a senior at YSU, and my last semester, or last quarter there at that point, and Dr. Lou Zona, who's the executive director of the Butler Institute of American Art, taught a course through the art department called Introduction to Museum Practices. And I actually had a minor in art and art history because of all the studio and art history work I brought from Cincinnati. And so I took that, and part of it was a weekly class session, and the rest of it was just practical work at the Butler, or at that point, the Arms Museum, which was operated by the Mahoning Valley Historical Society. And that was fascinating and fun. It was a great experience. And after I graduated, I wanted more. So I went back to ask if I could volunteer, be a tour guide, and then a position opened up that I was able to interview for and fill, and that was July 1st, 1987.
And you're still there. So it must be a great place. You must really still love history.
Well, I do, and really it's also the organization. I have grown up quite a bit in almost 34 years of working there. But the institution has grown, and the people that are involved, both staff members, board members, volunteers, have really brought so much to the Historical Society and allowed us to expand our horizons and most importantly, expand our physical plant.
Well, I am ashamed to admit this, but when I was younger, I didn't even know about the Arms Museum. I discovered the Arms Museum while I was at Youngstown State, and we got to have a tour of the museum, which is phenomenal, by the way. And as somebody who does appreciate architecture and the changes in how home structures and the layouts have changed over the periods of time, it's extremely interesting to me, the historical idea of the reason why the kitchen was the size that it was, why the living room was up front, why you did have this more sectioned off spaces than the open floor plan that you do now. So I love those things. Mm-hmm. And for all those other parents or teachers or just anybody out there who has an interest, can you explain to them what the Mahoning Valley Historical Society is all about? And how they could tap into this phenomenal resource that we have in the community.
Yes, well, there is the in-person experience, which is through the Arms Family Museum, 648 Wick Avenue, and Tyler History Center, which is downtown at 325 West Federal Street. We own and operate both of those facilities. The Arms Museum is a historic house, and the first floor is preserved as such. Mm-hmm. And then we've changed direction from being a all-encompassing local history museum. Thanks to opening up the Tyler History Center, we could focus more on our Historical Society's decorative arts collection. And that's what you see on the second floor in the galleries, and also to some extent in the basement gallery, which is very hands-on. And it's an arts and crafts style house from the early 20th century that Mr. and Mrs. Arms built to their own specifications. And that story in and of itself is interesting, and just the wonderful design cues from the arts and crafts movement, and also their own eclectic collections we talk about. But then that makes a perfect backdrop for looking at other periods of home design and home function, and people's clothing styles and the other textiles that people made and used in their house to keep warm, but also to make the house beautiful. And that's all on the second floor. And we have a huge collection of costumes and textiles and furniture. So we can change those things out and look at different periods and different styles. So a lot of people are interested in that. Down at Tyler History Center, we're talking more about the general social history of our region. Our collection really is strongest on city of Youngstown and the surrounding community suburbs, and to an extent also Mahoning County, because we don't have a county historical society, so Mahoning No. Valley Historical Society fills that role as well. And also at Tyler, we have the Archives Resource Center, which is just a tremendous collection for doing family history, learning about institutions, businesses, anything that relates to what people did when they came here. We have an education center at Tyler with classrooms, and eventually we're working on plans. We have another gallery on the third floor that needs to be fitted out. And it's going to be very hands-on and you know, learning.
Interactive,
that's the word. Thank you. And so we have those experiences. We do a lot of programming during normal times that we invite families and people to learn about other aspects of history. We do a great series every summer called History to Go. And that includes visiting historic neighborhoods for walking tours, going to historic sites to learn intensively about that particular building or site. We do every year, it's an annual event that's always well attended, a walking tour of Youngstown's Oak Hill Cemetery, which is a fabulous historical resource in and of itself. And so every year, 150, 200 people come out for that. Unfortunately, last year we were only to do one in-person program, which was our amazing history race, which is really a scavenger hunt that you get in your car to do. So it was easy to do social distancing.
Yeah, you don't have to really worry about people if they're in their own vehicles driving around.
Right. So it worked out for us, and people had a good time in the middle of the summer. But those things happen. We have resources at our website, MahoningHistory.org. For learning opportunities. We put a lot more of that up over the last 11 months just to provide alternatives to in-person programming.
So if I was to purchase any building, like even, you know, Derek McDowell, mm-hmm. he acquired the Northeast Ohio Northeast Fabricators. Mm-hmm. And then you have Penguin City that acquired the Republic Building. And then I know that there's other buildings up on the market downtown or fall within that opportunity zone. What would you, if the new homeowner wanted or building owner wanted to find out more about that location, where would you recommend they go to find the history of the building?
Call us, our Archives Resource Center, during hours when we're open, hopefully, which will be later this year in the spring. You can come and actually do research on our site. We've done so much with local property owners, local architects and engineers, real estate developers, to give them a sense of what happened on these sites or what the buildings were like in the past. And that's very important for developers and architects, because you don't want to run into surprises if you're on
no underground storage tanks, please.
Exactly. And, you know, so much of property is brownfield development. So something was there before, or you have, such as the two cases that you mentioned with Republic, which formerly mm-hmm. was a William B. Pollock company, and then where Youngstown Flea will be, which was once Youngstown Foundry and Machine. So their heavy industry obviously was happening there. Railroads crisscrossing through there. There could have been storage tanks, foundations that nobody knew about. But we have a lot of the resources that can help you find those things, including maps, atlases, the Sanborn fire insurance maps, which are so crucial because the sets that we have, some of them are still intact from the mid-20th century. So you can see structures and underground systems that are long gone or haven't been in use for 40 or 50 years.
So are you constantly collecting data now? Like if you walk by and you're like, like this whole style of a home with the white trim or whatever it may be, the fabrics that are being utilized, the styles that we wear today, just the fact of different industry coming in, you have Lordstown, you have the battery plant, all those different things that are happening. Are you constantly in the present collecting what would be known to be profound in the future?
Yes. And that is part of our process, not only preserving the collections we've had for now over 145 years, but thinking about what's going to be important for future generations to understand what's happening in our community today. So you're absolutely right.
We constantly have to be like,
yeah,
constantly thinking and critically thinking about everything and being like, you know what? I foresee that being something that is impactful to us now that is important for us to remember.
Yes, that's what we do. And we, in our profession and what we call public history, which is where you're actually preserving sites and collections and trying to understand them, or academic history is looking at those resources and formulating basically stories and also in larger patterns of history. But on the public side of it, we understand that our block of time is important.
Yes.
And that it is a block of time because there are many generations that have to benefit from what we're doing today. So we better do it right.
Yeah. Don't screw this up.
Yes.
So with that, and you, because you do, you have a constant access and glimpses every day of looking into where we were, even before the mills closed, when, like, I know when I look at my grandparents' pictures of them downtown wearing like the jackets, the hats, leaning against the buildings with the cigars hanging out of their mouths or whatever it may be, bands and everything that were happening down there. I mean, looking at the history of where we were, I mean, think about like Warner Theater, all these things. And then of course we did have the steel mills. You had the gas crisis, you had the steel mills, like all these things that impacted our area that did slow us down in our growth for a period of time, to put it lightly. And now you're seeing a bit of an uptick and a push forward again, which has been phenomenal. And of course, we're all trying to keep it pushing that way. I mean, what are your thoughts of how we take into account everything that happens to us historically and utilize that to help push us forward?
Well, I think my thought is what it's best that as community historians and not only teaching our audience, but also interacting with our audience, is we have to look at as many different perspectives as possible. Youngstown and Mahoning Valley 40 years ago became the poster child for deindustrialization, the Rust Belt, America left behind. But you can turn that around too. You can say that what happened in Youngstown predated what happened in Pittsburgh in terms of the collapse of the industry. It predated what happened in Detroit and Michigan with the great changes to the auto industry. And so from that standpoint, we were viewed nationally and internationally. That's why so many people outside this area are always interested in what's going on here, is really a test ground to what do we do after a certain industrial economy falls apart? Where does the community go after that? And then more recently with the changes and the shutdown at Lordstown as well, here's a reforming community. What do you do? You lost another big component of yes. your economic matrix. And so we're really, from that standpoint, we're leading. We're on the leading edge.
I like the way you're talking, Bill.
Well, I see it that way in terms of what we're going to be in the 21st century. And, you know, what do we do after Lordstown? Well, we're now becoming an electric vehicle hub mm-hmm. Through battery innovations, which are going to be manufactured, and also the workhorse electric truck. You have downtown Youngstown is a hub for additive manufacturing.
Yes.
That's huge.
Yes, it
that's,
is.
That's a game changer. And through local and federal investment that's happening right now, we're doing the research and development that's going to change the way manufacturing happens throughout this century. Something else demographically, and this is really part of our stress as a nation right now, is as a nation, we're moving toward a pluralistic society, meaning there's no more majority, especially no more majority white population.
Yes.
Well, Youngstown surpassed that, the city of Youngstown surpassed that more than 10 years ago. And we have a plurality, we have a majority-minority community. And so how are we making that adjustment, and how is power evolving in that new matrix? And those are things that are interesting right here and now. In our profession, what you might call prognostication is not really what we're here for, but those are going to be the hot topics of the future, especially the next 20 years. Another big one for this century is potable water.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, this is a global issue.
It is a global issue that we don't realize in the U.S. that we are very, very lucky versus other nations that are overseas abroad, that water is a major issue. It's a hot commodity over there that's not as easily accessible, that they look at us Americans as wasting water. Like, how dare you take a shower longer than 5 minutes? That's such a waste.
You're absolutely right. And also, even in this country, looking at what's going on in the plains and
yes.
in Southwest with population pressures on their water table supplies. You know, we're sitting literally in this region on billions and billions of gallons of fresh water, both in the ground and in reservoirs, and also a little further north of Great Lakes.
You know what's interesting, though, about that? We don't really have a map in the state of Ohio to be able to utilize and send that to those that are looking to basically create that plan or whatever, where they're tapping into our water resources underground.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried. I've reached out. We don't have it. And I will have to say the chamber was very helpful in guiding me to the resources of those who would have it. Unfortunately, though, they don't. But those are things that are it is good to have, and we do have that here. It's just being able to do the study. So if any engineer wants to go out there and start testing the soils and see where good places for anybody who wants to come in and build a plant, because it doesn't take much. It's just a structure over the ground and then for them to tap into.
Yes. But how we treat our water reserves is vitally important
yes.
to our future, but also the larger future of the country, I believe.
I agree too. And I love the fact that we are diversifying and working at diversifying our economic base as well, and not just solely going into one category. Like you said, we have the electric car, the battery on one side, and then we have additive manufacturing on the other. So I'm all about the more different, important base jobs coming into our area, the better, right?
Yes. And the more we do to train for the jobs of the future, which I think YSU has done a good job of that, looking forward, focusing on technology and STEM, but also continuing to be a university that offers a broader range of learning.
And then we have even the OWOW Museum that focuses on STEM, yes, which is absolutely phenomenal. Like, I love that we have that resource downtown as well.
Yes.
Looking forward to their expansion as well. So we have the Tyler expansion and the OWOW expansion. That'll be cool.
Well, we're very happy and proud that we're part of the new downtown offerings, not only for education and entertainment, but just being an institutional presence there.
That's right. It is a tremendous resource, and you do help create the community, and it's important. It's very important.
Yes.
So the other thing I want to tap into, it is Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say in our area would be a great story to reflect on Black history here?
Well, there's many great stories. And I think that the important thing in local Black history is to understand that it's part of our whole history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have recorded written evidence of an African-American man being in Youngstown in 1806.
Oh, wow.
Which is 25 years before anybody knew of somebody actually living here. His name was Peter.
Yeah, the OWOW was the 1806 portion.
Right. Yes. And we found that through the session records of First Presbyterian Church. The session would be like the church council of lay people that run it. And in their time, they were, shall we say, almost a moral police force. And so they had members who didn't do what they're supposed to do, and they brought them in and had a trial with them. And in one of these trials, the witness was a man named Peter, who was listed as a man of color, and he gave testimony. He doesn't appear in the 1810 census. I'm sure he wasn't there in 1800, but he was there in 1806. So we've had African Americans all through this region coming in as domestics and farmhands early on in that first decade of the 19th century. The community started building in Youngstown in particular, but also in Warren, 1820s, 1830s, right up to the Civil War. The African American community grew after the Civil War as former slaves
had their exodus,
left their plantations, yes, and started coming here. Of course, in Youngstown in particular, you had a building boom after the Civil War that went into the 1880s and 1890s, and a lot of African-American tradesmen caught on to that and came here and put in roots. A couple of the famous ones were P. Ross Berry and Lemuel Stewart, that were both master bricklayers and masons who were involved with building some of the best and most well-known structures of the city of Youngstown and all through the region in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so there was a gradual building of the African-American community when we got into the Steel Age. Unfortunately, we had a big strike here in the valley in 1919. And a lot of the replacement workers, or scabs as they're known in unions,
Still to this day,
they were African Americans that came from wherever and were filling jobs and were hated and scorned for it. But the community, the biggest boost to building the African American community was actually after 1924, when you had the comprehensive immigration laws federally that really turned off the flow of immigrants coming from Europe and the Mediterranean.
Oh, wow.
And so
I didn't know that.
The demand for labor was still very strong. And so the local steel companies sent recruiters to the rural South and went to church congregations and said, we've got jobs and streets paved with gold and all that they did even with the European immigrants.
I mean, we did have brick
We had brick, yes, and but we had jobs, and so the Great Migration started then, the mid-20s, slowed down during the Great Depression, and then picked up again during World War II because of labor demands, and then really exploded after World War II because of labor demands and not having too many immigrants coming into the country, and that really helped build our local and regional African-American community to what it is today in terms of numbers and the families that are represented and the various work and political leadership and civic and educational leadership going on in the community. It's not always an easy story because it any time, and it's human nature, the most recent arrivals are often scorned by the ones that came right before them because there's a threat.
It's very true.
You're on the bottom of the job market and you're worried about keeping a job and building up seniority and pay. And you see somebody different from you, it's a very negative thing. And that happened here. I can almost say the great diversity that we have in this community is obvious, and we all share in that in terms of our part, our facet of where our ancestors came from. But we have to admit too that we share in some of the animosity and mistrust that came about in that whole process. And so again, teaching about our history and showing not only the great accomplishments and achievements, but also where things went sour.
How else are you going to learn?
Right. And case in point, the Ku Klux Klan of the early 1920s, which wasn't primarily driven by, you know, white supremacy and racist attitudes, even though they were there, but it was primarily an anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish movement. And it was ugly, to say the least. And then things changed after a 3 or 4 year period where the Klan really had some dominance in politics and changing public policy. But getting back to the African American community, it's a great story. There's a lot of great individual people stories that go with that as far as success in the professions, in business, in labor leadership and organization. African Americans were critical in the 1930s and early 40s to getting industry-wide representation through what became the United Steelworkers of America, because the big difference with that union movement was it was not focused on skilled positions. It was focused on organizing everyone, unskilled and skilled alike. Unfortunately, because of the way the steel mills operated, African Americans never rose up into the ranks into supervisor positions or head of departments, and they saw this union movement as a chance to move ahead in the industry, and it did work for them after we had nationwide representation of the major steel industry players. And of course, it wasn't an easy process then either, because
nothing's ever easy.
No, but it happened, and it improved everybody's situation. But it was a little tough struggle to get there.
Well, we still continuously have our tough struggles, but I do believe that we'll get there. And then once we get there, we'll find a new struggle that we need to work through and achieve for. But like they say in yoga, there's always places to grow, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We are at I can't believe I'm forgetting her name, but she did the phenomenal poem at the inauguration. I know, right? I mean, this girl is probably the most brilliant person I've ever listened to, and she's only 24.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, we are constantly a growing nation, basically, was the gist of it, is that this is just things that for us to recognize and face and grow from. And that's the beauty of America, is that we do.
Absolutely.
So ready for the fun part?
Sure.
The rapid round.
Okay.
So now that you've had your three beers, what is your favorite beer or brewery?
I don't have a lot of experience with the local craft and microbrews, but as I mentioned, I'm very familiar with Penguin City, Youngstown based, and also Noble Creature up on East Rand Avenue. And so I just have to say, from that standpoint, those are
Noble Creature and Penguin City. It does make sense. Does make sense. Are you gonna? You can put those on your walking route.
Absolutely.
100%. What's your favorite local restaurant?
I'd have to say it's our neighborhood place. We live over on the west side, but Casa Ramirez. Very good regional Mexican food, and then the usual things that Americans like. But if you get into their menu in terms of what they brought, the traditions and recipes from the Michoacan region of Mexico, delicious. And
I haven't been there. I'm going to have to go.
Yes, and we're there a lot with takeout now. There's so many good pizza places here.
I know.
You got to have a favorite pizza.
It's difficult because I feel like you can choose pizza based on your mood of pizza, which is weird because you can be like Emmanuel's, the Chicago deep dish pizza, or the New York style pizza, or ours, which I feel like our base pizza, and which I spoke with Jeremy, the Youngstown Pizza Review.
Mm-hmm.
And ours is a bit doughier.
Yes. And it's nice and thick. My favorite, because it's somewhat different than everybody else's, is the Elmton.
Everybody says the Elmton. Anybody who's truly done the taste test of pizza in our area always falls back on the Elmton. Well, I haven't had it yet.
The crust is like pastry. And two words that set it apart, Swiss cheese.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's different.
That is different.
And it's delicious.
All right. Well, it is on our list to try because we're trying to hit up. I mean, we have, I think, 64 different local pizza places to hit up this year.
I believe it.
And I'm sure we are not getting everyone on the list, but it's definitely a pizza year 2021 in the Resnick household. And the last question I have, what is your favorite local gem of the area?
Like a historic place, or
it could be any favorite place that you want to say, whether it's like the patio at Aqua or one of the cemeteries. I know Nicole Ice mentioned the cemetery in Columbiana.
Mm-hmm.
You can mention whatever you want. What would Mill Creek Park, of course, is predominantly mentioned.
Well, I'm going to mention one place in Mill Creek Park, and it's fairly close to our house, but Slippery Rock Picnic Pavilion.
Oh.
Have you ever been there?
I have.
If you like arts and crafts, period, and the philosophy of combining and melding into nature, I mean, it is one of the most organic structures I've seen. It looks like it's always been there.
Yes.
And
it does.
And it's just a fantastic work of arts and crafts, period, public picnic pavilion. And I'll say that to anybody. It's unmatched.
Well, there you go. So, and you can run by it. I run by it, don't I? It's right by the road that you can end up on. Glenwood, is it, that I end up on? Or Mahoning? I forget which one I end up on.
Yeah, you can go up to the Falls Avenue entrance, mm-hmm. where the old office building is. You come down, I think that's East Glacier Drive.
Yes.
You pass Lake Glacier, and then you, where the bridge is, and then you just go another 100 yards from there. And it's right there before you go up the hill.
I was about to say, it goes up right
to
before the hill.
Yes. Road. Yes.
It's better going down the hill, trust me.
Well, yes.
Thank you very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Thank you. And if people want to hear more about the Mahoning Valley Historical Society,
yes.
What's your website?
MahoningHistory.org.
Okay.
We're on Facebook, Instagram.
You name it.
You name it. YouTube, we have a channel there. A lot of great videos and programs we've done over the years. Call us. 330-743-2589. We're not open, but we have people there. We'll, eventually we can get your message and get back to you.
Well, hopefully 2021 we'll be all back together, being able to do walking tours and everything else.
We hope so.
Fingers crossed and toes. Thank you.